Technicians of Spaceship Earth, do not panic.
Do not panic.
Do not panic. This is Hawk Binge, your air raid shelter from the sonic destruction that is the Hawkwind discography, one album at a time, in the company of your long-term fan, which is yours truly, and our first-time listener, which is Matt in New York. How are you doing, Matt?
I am emerging from my cocoon, thank you, Andy. I haven't had so much sonic attack, but weather attack again. It's been a strange march that have gone from just rain to snow and back again. So I haven't actually been doing that much. And annoyingly, last night, my new puppy, who is about 5 months and is a glorious little thing, but managed to eat something on the street and then proceeded to throw it up over the course of most of last night. So between that and daylight savings time, which has just kicked in over here, I lost an hour and a lot of sleep. So we'll see how well this recording goes.
Oh dear. That sounds like your dog had one of my Friday nights. Aside from that, I am off to Barbados tomorrow. So yeah, sunnier climes.
Oh, that's why we had to record today.
That is why we had to record today. Yes, I'm going to watch England embarrass themselves on the cricket field and not care.
That's amazing. I suppose, yeah, when you're in such nice surroundings, they can lose as much as they need to, and you can still have fun.
Exactly, exactly. That is very much the plan. So here we are, Sonic Attack. This one feels like it's been coming for a long time and has very, very weird timing for an album like this, given what's going on in the world. Definitely had pause for thought many times while playing this one. But as ever, this is not all we've been listening to while we've been preparing for the show. What else has been on the turntable, Matt?
Well, Andy, I was inspired by two things that I was able to do during the terrible weather that I've been enduring here. And one of the things was to go and see Bonobo live, who came and did a show at Avant Gardner, which is close to me. It's a very large kind of warehouse arena. I think he was supposed to do it pre-COVID. And, you know, it's that time now where all the gigs are finally coming in. And it was the first time, I think, possibly for the venue, but certainly for me, that they were able to fill it to the actual capacity. So it was the first time that I was surrounded by so many people for a long time. It was kind of weird. I'm a big Bonobo fan and was always fascinated by his ability to have a very kind of dance music sensibility, but bring in instrumentation that weren't just, you know, beepy boopy synths. You know, he's been working with string orchestras and brass and woodwind and all this kind of stuff. It feels very his sound. And he actually had 8 or 9 musicians with him playing. So as well as him bringing down the house with crazy beats, he had these musicians with him. So there was a really nice stage show, great lights, great projections, everything that you look for in a great gig. So for my awakening back into that big stadium style live music, this was a great one to have as a first taste again. So I will be adding to the playlist a track that he played, which I'm a huge fan of. And also the person who sings on this track, a guy called Grey Reverend, actually came out on stage to sing this, which was a particular highlight. So I will be adding First Fires from his album The North Borders to the turntable playlist, and hopefully the good times are back again.
That sounds like a winner, definitely. And you've always talked about Bonobo, so I can imagine that was definitely a good one for you. Anything else?
Yeah, another thing I did kind of because of the weather, but also because I thought I should get around to this at some point, is that I alphabetized my record collection. When I came to America, I pretty much showed up with a suitcase full of clothes, a laptop, and about 1,500 records. That was kind of what I owned at that point.
The essentials.
Yeah, I remember the moving company being like, are you serious? And I'm like, yes, and not a scratch on any of them, or you're in so much trouble. So they did actually take great care of them. And that record collection is now gone from London to San Francisco and is now in New York. So it's quite a well-traveled collection that slowly grows like some kind of audio fungus in my room. But I never bothered to alphabetize them. And one really wet weekend, I was like, do you know what? I should do this, because the problem with records is that they look great and they sound great, but if you can't find one, then there's no use in having them. So alphabetizing them does actually do some good. I think I made this joke a podcast or two ago. the amount of records I still have in their cellophane was kind of embarrassing. So I made a subcategory of things which I hadn't opened and made it my mission to open some of them. And one of the ones I opened was an album called Hollywood Medieval by Maxwell Sterling. And he's a almost Philip Glass style composer who put this album together whilst he was working as a nanny in Hollywood, whilst also studying film composition at the University of Los Angeles. So it's a very strange collagic kind of piece where he takes all these strange iPhone recordings from all the houses that he was looking after and then combining that with some very old synthesizers. Like I think he's got a DX7 and a Juno 60 on there and makes these strange, hazy, odd, very textural, avant-garde sounding works. So I put that on, and sometimes when I pick up a record that's definitely still in its cellophane, I listen to it and I try and guess why I bought it because it's, you know, sometimes you're just like, it mattered to me then. And therefore there are these interesting kind of like audio milestones of things that mattered. But listening to it again, the first time through, I was like, I'm not quite sure I get this. And then I listened to it again and realized that it is just designed to be this kind of soundscapey experimental thing. Kind of reminds me a little bit of those like 1 minute things that Hawkwind throw into their albums a bit. So there's kind of a link there. So I've been enjoying listening to that. That is now open and will go into its own little bit of alphabetized space. And I will hopefully over the next couple of podcasts, open a few more and discover exactly what I thought when I was buying it all that time ago. The track that I'm going to share with everyone is called $50 Curse Removal. And yeah, that's on Hollywood Medieval by Maxwell Sterling on the Death of Rave label, which if you're ever looking for strange music, but really good strange music, the Death of Rave is a fantastic label to go check out.
Very good. That sounds like a winner. I like the idea of going back through lots of unopened things, like buying them for a second time.
Yeah, I definitely know that I drunk Discogs occasionally. I know that I've done that and then not remembered. And, you know, 3 or 4 days later, something arrives in the post and I'm like, what was I thinking when I got that? So this may well have been one of those, but certainly, yeah, it's a nice way to even surprise yourself with presents to yourself from a version of yourself that is no longer around.
My version of that was doing tours of Brighton secondhand record shops and buying records on cover art value alone. And this was a purposeful move by me to not buy on vinyl things that I'd liked for years but didn't have on vinyl, i.e. just replacing something, if you like. I thought, no, I must take the opportunity to have something new. So I probably did this a few times and ended up with one or two gems and a bunch of albums that I kind of half enjoyed listening to once, and probably that's going to be the end of it. But they've all got good covers. I'll say that for them. I've got a couple of things here, one of which was going to be my turntable pick last time out, if you remember, and I swapped it out at the very last minute for the White Hills and Nod. And it's something I was listening to in New York quite a lot and then have come back to several times since. And I cannot remember where I saw it, but I was watching something on TV months and months ago and a video came on. And I thought, oh, yeah, them. Oh, that's good. I like that. And then got into it. And the band is Royal Blood, Brighton's very own. And the track was Boilermaker. And it just had this instant punch you in the face. You totally get this after like 5 seconds. This is amazing. It doesn't go in lots of different directions. It's just very simple, incredibly catchy. And I got into it. And then I started listening to the album. And I listened to Royal Blood's first album, which I thought was good. But I didn't really become like a hardcore Royal Blood fan. They were just a band. I could put the album on every now and again in the office or whatever. But this album I played, the album Typhoons, which is their latest, I played over and over and over. It's released on Warner Records. I guess it's probably a year or two old at this point, but they're probably still touring it, I would think. And when you listen to it, it just sounds like Brighton's answer to Queens of the Stone Age. Or it sounds like Queens of the Stone Age with different lyrics. And it turns out that Josh Homme actually produced this album. So there's no quirk of fate that it sounds like Queens of the Stone Age. But that's not doing it down, because it sounds like Queens of the Stone Age in a rather brilliant way. So excellent album. Boilermaker is the track. I could play it at any time and instantly feel the urge to move around. So yeah, that's the one I was going to come with. I've listened to it again fairly recently, so it's not even retrospective. It's still kind of on the turntable.
I don't know that one. I need to check that out, because I think that anything that sounds like Queen of the Stone Age, considering that Queen of the Stone Age isn't really putting anything out, I think is a completely good and fair and valid thing to be doing.
Totally. It's the dancier side of Queens of the Stone Age. And Boilermaker's also got a brilliant video that's worth checking out on YouTube. So yeah, really, really good band. And actually, I'm going to go and see them later this year. I was motivated to get a ticket to see them. That's at the O2.
Oh, nice.
Weirdly, I've got a lot of O2 tickets this year. I've probably been to the O2 to see bands like once every 2 or 3 years, the bands that I would go and see at the O2 actually play there. Because obviously, we're now more the Camden clubs than the O2. But this year, a number of bands are playing the O2 that I'm going to see. Genesis, Porcupine Tree.
Porcupine Tree are playing the O2. That's big.
Yes, it is, isn't it? Because we saw them play the Royal Albert Hall, and we saw them play the Royal Festival Hall.
Yeah, I was going to say, we saw them play Indigo.
That was on the...
Fear of a Blank Planet.
That's right, which is actually quite a long time ago now. That's a good 10, 12 years ago. Actually, more like 15 years ago now. We were just becoming friends when we saw that, basically. That was one of the first things that we went to see.
I'm not sure that Indigo even exists, does it?
No, I don't think it does. I think there is just another room in there called the O2 that some smaller bands play. So yeah, they're coming back. Their legend has grown, Porcupine Tree, kind of while they've been away. And they've got a new album coming out. The two tracks off it I've heard sound amazing. So yeah, it seems to be a bit of an O2 year this year. The other band that I've been listening to recently is also related to a live gig, but one I actually have been to already rather than one that I plan to go to. And that is that at Chalk in Brighton, which is a very small club in Brighton, I saw Gong. And I'd had those tickets for about a year, I think. I can't remember if it was postponed or how often or whatever, but suddenly this Gong gig was looming large. So then checked to see if, you know, if they got a new release that they're touring. And in fact, they had a new album in 2019. Now, you and I saw Gong at Roadburn in 2017. And they are a fascinating band. I mean, somebody needs to do Gong Binge. They really do, because the story of Gong is long. They have lots of different lineups and lots of different phases and different people dominate and all this kind of thing. But the Dave Brock of Gong, a man called David Allen, he was the leader of the band. He died in 2015, but they had the kind of lineup that could continue without David Allen, with his blessing. He, I believe, wrote a letter to say you should continue and this guy should be your frontman, a guy called Kavis Tarabi. That was the lineup that we saw at Roadburn. And, you know, they were blinding. I remember being really blown away by how good they were. So I was excited to see them. So I saw the gig. They were, you know, they're fantastic players. Tarabi is a brilliant frontman. The stuff they play just sounds amazing. It was a tiny little gig. And I tweeted that I'd seen this gig and that I thought the album was great. And Gong Planet actually replied to point out that they have a live album out this year of the tours they've done over the last couple of years. So I listened to that. And that's even better because much though I love the newer stuff, I'm probably the fan that annoys all of the older fans by liking the newer stuff. But Pulsing Signals is the album on K-Scope, which their studio album from 2019, The Universe Also Collapses, is also on K-Scope. That I've been listening to, and they just feel like a band to me which is much more raw and edgy live and just sounds amazing. And so I love the live version of the songs. The song Capital is my pick from there, which is actually from the album they released in 2016 or 17 called Rejoice I'm Dead, which was the album they were touring when we saw them at Roadburn. So Gong, yep, absolutely should strike a nerve with a lot of our listeners. There's quite a lot of crossover, I would say, between the classic Hawkwind and classic Gong crowd. But that's a wicked album. It sounds absolutely contemporary. They just sound like a brilliant pulsing live band, hence Pulsing Signals. So those are my two, Royal Blood and Gong. We have quite a crowded show today, actually, because obviously there is the usual look at 81 and the albums that are released and the track by track and everything else. But we also have a rather exciting announcement. So stay tuned for that. But in advance of that, Matt, we've had some mail.
Yes, it was nice to come back from the ether for season two and get a whole bunch of nice messages and encouraging support. So thank you very much to everyone who does leave us messages. I'm going to go through a few that caught my eye over the last few weeks. Wayne Jeffries emailed us to say that he thinks that Pork Binge has been a very informative and enjoyable podcast, which is always a great way of starting an email. That definitely guarantees I will read the rest of it. he appreciates the effort and background that goes into them, which I think is another compliment to your good self, Andy. He feels like like the last three or four albums clumped together represent a kind of mini era, which I guess is something you were talking about as well. Like, I feel like both you and Joe have talked about Hawkwind almost in label eras, like different times and different management produces different Hawkwinds. So I guess that makes sense. But Wayne said that he is kind of happy that they didn't carry on with the lineup that they made Levitation with, because he likes what Hugh and Tim do, but he also thought that Ginger Baker's input was possibly a little bit too much. He says, to make a comparison, it's a bit like Neil Peart came along and made an album with Led Zeppelin or something like that, and he misses Simon King's drive, even if Ginger was technically the more quote-unquote superior drummer, which I think is fair enough. I think we talked about that, about Hawkwind. When they're a little bit rough around the edges, they have a very different vibe to them, where although Levitation is a really interesting blip, I think we're all happy that they've gone back to something a little bit more maybe expected, which we will be talking about very soon. David Collinge on Instagram says that he finds himself playing the tracks before and after our podcast to really appreciate the opinions, and then he hears and understands more than he ever feels he did. So said cheers, guys, for that, which is awesome. That means the podcast is working as intended, at least for one person. Angry Saints is obviously catching up because left a message on PXR5 saying great show and episode. Thank you very much, Angry Saints. They said that PXR5 is possibly their favorite Calvert era album and always goes back to it. He remembers reading that Uncle Sam's on Mars actually came out because Calvert started an ad lib over Opa-Loka during live shows. And so that became the actual track. So that's pretty awesome to hear that once again, a live event has then produced this finished work. And I do feel like Hawkwind does a lot of that. You know, there's always room for experimentation and messing about and then seeing what that germinates into. It's very different to, say, like the Beatles documentary where, like, you know, George Harrison just comes in and says, I made this last night, and just plays a whole track. And everyone goes, cool, I guess we'll figure that out. This feels much more like messing around and just streams of consciousness sticking and then becoming insipid and growing into things, which is super cool. Darren Evanson replied to us on YouTube for Levitation, saying a great return with an absolute stone cold classic from a brief but amazing lineup of musicians, which were all fated to implode on the road, which, yes, so it goes with this band for sure. Baker being sacked for being an absolute tyrant and Blake being abandoned at the Hanley gig after a riposte with Brock. I didn't know that, but again, that sounds very, very believable. So 100% agree with all of that. He also said that he loves the new graphics, which is awesome. I was able to spend a bit of time over Christmas trying to come up with something more 80s for the season two, so I'm glad that that is liked by one person. And mentions that Miss Stacia is a true legend, an absolute genuine beautiful person who has embraced social media to respond to her many fans, which is very cool. Actually, do we follow her? We should follow her. We should reach out. We should say hi.
Yes, absolutely. Darren also posted the YouTube episode to a Hawkwind group on Facebook, which is great because it's brilliant when, you know, listeners turn into evangelists for you. That definitely helps, I think, to get some new people in. He said that it should be part of your regular listening because there's so much material to deep dive into. Well, no argument from us on that one, Darren. And Darren just said that he has a lot of respect for what we're doing. So it's nice that somebody does.
Right. And maybe it was Darren then who helped get us an absolute slew of subscribers after spending what feels like half of season one asking if people would subscribe to us and getting, like, you know, closer and closer to 100. We suddenly in like 2 days blew past it to get to almost 150. So thank you very much, everyone who subscribes. We are now /Hawkbinge on youtube.com. So we're much easier to find now. And we just all feel much more official and validated and everything. So a personal thank you from me for my little project of trying to get Hawkwind on to YouTube has now been met with success. So that's great.
A pretty significant percentage of our listens actually comes from our YouTube channel. So that seems to be quite a preferred way of getting hold of Hawkbinge for a lot of people out there. So welcome aboard, everybody who's joined since we hit the magic ton. It's great to have you on board. And I hope you'll stick with it.
Joe Banks reached out to us, Andy, and on YouTube, actually, and said, hey, guys, great to have you back, and corrected us about the John the Bog story, which was interesting. He said it's actually Nick who made the error in that quote, and the roadie who had the elbow accident was actually John the Dump. John the Bog, who got his name by dealing acid in the toilets of the UFO club, was the band's road manager on the Space Ritual tour, but was killed coming back from one of the gigs when the van he was in was involved in a collision on the North Circular. So a different John came to a sticky end, unfortunately.
Yes, that's I don't even know what to say about that, really. John the Bog, John the Dump, Sticky Ends. It's all rather unsatisfactory, isn't it?
But again, why wouldn't any of that happen?
Yeah, it's awkward.
Another regular contributor to our comment section, Elric Newby, said, glad you're going to use the Hawkwind saga. Such a great book, which is awesome. That's the new one that we are starting to reference. He said also, thanks again for using my book as a reference, which we will continue to do so, Elric, because that is an awesome book and definitely part of our Hawk Binge bibliography.
It absolutely is.
His book actually runs out at 2017, but that means that we have plenty of more of his book we can get through. He said he was interested to see how Matt would take to the 80s, more measured, clean sound, and glad that I like it thus far. He said the 80s can be a bit of a polarizing period for Hawkwind fans, but most people like Levitation. He's a fan of some of the 80s, so some great albums to come, which gives me lots of hope for season two.
Yes, absolutely. It's interesting. I guess the 70s... are like canon. You can't really be a Hawkwind fan and not like the 70s. It's like the classic period. There are so many great albums to come, but you're now into a period where the fandom is definitely like this album, don't like that album quite so much, love that album, this one's a bit meh, and there'll be different albums for everybody, which kind of makes it fascinating. Because you probably won't find too many Hawkwind fans would go back to Space Ritual and Hall of the Mountain Grill or Quark, Strangers and Charm and say, oh, I didn't really like that one. You get one or two, but it's pretty much, if you're a Hawkwind fan, you have to like those ones. And then after that, then people start to pick and choose, which makes it really fascinating. And we're in a really interesting era now. And that era is, of course, the 1980s, and we are in 1981. 81 is interesting because we're looking at a whole lot of bands and albums here that I remember. I was in school in 81, which means obviously I'm surrounded by people listening to what's new, and things like Top of the Pops were regular watching, and I think we were starting to see stuff happening on different channels. Can't remember when Channel 4 began, but you know, I remember music and culture was a big thing for Channel 4 when it kicked off, with things like The Tube and whatever. That feels like it might be a bit later, I'm not really sure. But yeah, we're into an era now where it's less the misty pasts and the classic things that I was way too young or not born yet or whatever. And we're into things that were current when I was getting into music. So this is kind of an interesting one for me. And my brother likes a lot of the things that we'll talk about. In particular, Madness, their album 7, comes out in 1981. Police, Ghost in the Machine, brother had that. That's 81. Depeche Mode come out with Speak and Spell, big album. Huge album for Rush, Moving Pictures, which is the one with Tom Sawyer on it, which is awesome. Phil Collins announces himself with Face Value. That begins the Phil Collins era where you couldn't not see Phil Collins' face almost everywhere. Smokey Robinson, Being With You. The Boomtown Rats, remember them? Mondo Bongo, that comes out in 81. Spandau Ballet, God Help Us All, Journeys to Glory, that comes out in 81. Status Quo, Never Too Late. Weaker album for The Who, Face Dances, at least I think so, comes out in 81. Not a big fan of Miles Davis in the 80s, but he comes out with two albums, Directions and The Man with the Horn. The Cure come out with Faith, Jefferson Starship, there's a name for the 80s, Modern Times, Pill come out with The Flower of Romance in 81. Roger Taylor comes out with his first solo album. He's the drummer in Queen. He comes out with Fun in Space. Probably shouldn't be on this list because it didn't dent the charts and no one really cares about it, but I really like it. So it makes the list. Van Halen, Fair Warning, Kraftwerk, Computer Word. Here's Grace Jones and Night Clumbing. I absolutely remember that. Couple from Frank Zappa, Tinseltown Rebellion, which was an album my brother bought for me and still gets played, and You Are What You Is. The Undertones, remember them? Positive Touch. The big album for Toya, Anthem, comes out in 81, and she was ubiquitous. She was everywhere at this point. Good album for Susie and the Banshees, Juju. George Harrison, funnily enough, you mentioned him earlier. He comes back with Somewhere in England. Duran Duran and Kim Wilde both have eponymous albums out this year. One of the great live albums, No Sleep Till Hammersmith from Motorhead, which kind of, I think of Space Ritual here because it's rare for a band to have the album everybody knows and their highest charting album, whatever, to be a live one. But Motorhead and Hawkwind kind of share that. No Sleep Till Hammersmith is a hell of a record. Contrasting with that, village people have Renaissance in 81. Foreigner come out with 4 Cameo. I remember them. They had the singer with the big codpiece, Knights of the Sound Table. Bucks Fizz, they won the Eurovision Song Contest. Really didn't like them at all. But still, that damn song is in my head. I can remember it. That's bad. Pat Benatar, Precious Time. The Rolling Stones, Tattoo You. Brother had that as well. I think they've just released that. Devo, New Traditionalists, comes out at this point. Genesis have Abacab, which is them going into quite a poppy kind of a vein there. Level 42, remember Mark King, that amazing bass player? I watched Rocky Horror Show for the first time in ages recently and was kind of blown away by what an amazing singer Tim Curry is. And then when I was looking through the list of 81 albums, Tim Curry has an album called Simplicity. I'm guessing it's the same Tim Curry. Might not be, but I haven't heard any of it. But amazing voice in Rocky Horror. Hall & Oates, Private Eyes, U2, October, my favourite Bauhaus album, Mask, comes out this year. Olivia Newton-John, Physical, I remember that being in the charts. And Adam and the Ants, which I bought at the time, Prince Charming. 2 huge albums for Sabs fans out there. Black Sabbath come out with Mob Rules. And Ozzy Osbourne's second solo album, Diary of a Madman, comes out this year as well. 2 amazing albums there. Echo and the Bunnymen, Heaven Up Here, brother was a fan of them. Motley Crue, Too Fast for Love, brother was not a fan of them. Japan, Tin Drum, amazing album. New Order, their first album. So Ian Curtis, I think, committed suicide the year before. So this is their first album in their new guise. Earth, Wind and Fire, with Ray's Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, have an album out this year. Joan Jett and the Blackhearts have an album out. AC/DC, For Those About to Rock, is this year. ABBA, their final album, The Visitors, comes out this year. And it's pretty good. I've got to say, I really like that album. The Teardrop Explodes come out with Wilder. King Crimson come out with one of the albums of any era, Discipline. If you haven't heard it, give it a listen. It's absolutely astounding. Diana Ross releases Why Do Fools Fall in Love on RCA. And this is the year that she was paid $20 million to move from Motown to RCA, which I reckon is about $20 million more than Hawkwind were paid to move from Bronze to RCA. Also this year, albums from Ultravox, Boney M, Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, Kool & the Gang, the Allman Brothers, and Bryan Adams kind of round things out, give you a sense of the time. Ordinarily, I would leave it there, but actually we had a message from John Bedeth. John, in amongst saying some rather nice things about us, also was wondering why I never include UFO albums in these annual lists. So, John, this is for you. UFO release The Wild, The Willing and The Innocent in 1981. Box ticked. So, let's see what Hawkwind are doing in 1981. We've just mentioned that they've left Bronze. Amusingly, Gary Bron, the owner of Bronze, said they did quite well with Hawkwind, but that Hawkwind could be quite lazy. They just wanted to do a live album so they didn't have to write any songs, which kind of just endears them to me slightly more, actually. But they are on the road at this point, and them being on the road makes for some interesting reading. This is in Ian Abrams' book, Hawkwind Sonic Assassins. So they're doing some shows, and those shows were right at the commencement of recording the next studio LP to be called Sonic Attack. And while they were significant statements they made about support for the counterculture and the festival scene, as with the Futurama Festival back at the start of the Bronze Era, they also presented themselves as opportunities for the band to reveal the latest twists and turns in their sound and identity, replacing the clearly defined rock sound of the previous couple of years with something altogether more industrial and grungy. At the same time, to appear on the pyramid stage at Glastonbury as the festival started to reinvent itself, in part as a vehicle for CND funding, was a major achievement, despite it being an embryonic revival of the festival, far from its massive attendance and corporate ethos of today. It was a cracking performance full of energy and purpose, setting the scene for the band that would be the latest to emerge from under the Hawkwind banner. So, doing pretty well off the back of 2 successful albums with Bronze and being on the road, playing Stonehenge and playing the Pyramid Stage at Glastonbury, which is, as Ian says, might not look like it does today, but it's a pretty big statement. So, who is the band at this point going into the studio to record Sonic Attack. Well, Dave Brock and Harvey Bainbridge and Hugh Lloyd Langton from the previous incarnation, Hugh being the sole remaining Galactico from that lineup, Ginger Baker has moved on to be replaced by Martin Griffin, who was, of course, the drummer in the Hawklords. On the keyboards, Tim Blake has gone and Keith Hale has arrived, and Keith Hale has gone and not been replaced. So Dave and Harvey are going to do keyboards on this album. And we see an actual appearance on the album by Michael Moorcock himself. And we spoke about Michael Moorcock a fair bit back in Space Ritual and then Warrior on the Edge of Time. He was quite a big part of both of those scenes and has been a part of the band throughout. So he is actually on this album. And of course, he wrote the title track, Sonic Attack. So the album is recorded in June through August at Rockfield. So they're back at Rockfield now. It's released in October of 81 and makes number 19. So it's a pretty good charting effort for Hawkwind. And going back to Ian Abrams, he says this of the album. The first ICA album, Sonic Attack, was an altogether different animal from its recent predecessors. It had a gritty tone, for all the world like an updated and technologically advanced version of Do Re Mi Fa Sol La Ti Do. Looking at Carol Clark's book, The Saga of Hawkwind, she says of Sonic Attack, Sonic Attack, released by RCA Active, was hailed by many as a return to form, a hard-ass take on space rock with none of the fanciful diversions that had coloured their work from time to time since the mid-70s. Dave Brock still thinks of it as a pretty good album, in quotes. So no frisbee antics with the vinyl this time around, and it's received a rather beautiful re-release now. This is the 40th anniversary reissue of the album. Mine has travelled through time, probably sideways, because the sticker on mine says it's the 45th anniversary. So I reckon I've got this one 5 years ahead of everybody else, and it should be worth an absolute fortune. But it's on heavyweight blue vinyl. It's absolutely beautiful. It includes the lyric sheet, and there is the single of Angels of Death, which is backed by the non-album song Transdimensional Man. So a beautiful release, which I've been playing. And if you want to see actually that reissue of Sonic Attack unveiled, then you should check out Stephen E. Andrews on YouTube. He has a YouTube channel and he goes by the name The Outlaw Bookseller. And it's a brilliant YouTube channel, which should be of interest to pretty much any Hawkwind fan, really, because he is a very well-read person and looks at science fiction books from different authors, from PKD to Michael Moorcock and a great many others. I think he's in the book trade. And so he's constantly reviewing books. He looks at albums as well, doing unboxing. He's done a lot of Stranglers and a fair bit of Hawkwind. And he's made a little playlist of his Hawkwind videos. And they're well worth a watch. And he unboxes, or rather unwraps, the re-release of Sonic Attack on his channel. So you should definitely check that out. And now it's time to check out what Matt thinks of Sonic Attack.
I think it's very easy to agree with both of the authors that you quoted there. I think that after Levitation, which was much more of a musical album and an album which felt like it had its own place in context, space and time, Sonic Attack feels more like Hawkwind making an album for the fans. You know, like the fact that it's a big return to familiar themes and audio techniques and even songs that we know and love about Hawkwind. So I do feel like after there's another big switch up in personnel, someone made the decision that they should go back to being more like Hawkwind and maybe stop experimenting a little bit with Hawkwind being overly professional. And I feel like a lot of that comes through in this album. It's a little bit more scattershod for me. It's a little bit retrospective. Weirdly, it's the first time in a while that listening to a Hawkwind album has felt long. Like by the time the last track is over, I feel like time has definitely passed. Where when I was listening to things like 25 years, I felt like it was over in a heartbeat. This actually does feel like it's of album length and it's somehow taking up my time in a different way. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's something that I've noticed. For me personally, this goes back to some Hawkwind habits, which I'm not the biggest fan of, but they're brought up to date in different ways. So I do feel like there's a chance to explore them in different ways. You know, it's not just that they've done the same thing again. They are taking things apart and putting them back together again and seeing how they work. So the inclusion of Sonic Attack as a track and calling it Sonic Attack again is what makes it feel a bit like it's returning to some of those themes. And the fact that even Moorcock's involved makes me feel like maybe he hasn't let that go either, and he still thinks it's a really good idea and wants it to be included and that kind of thing. And I was wondering if even the idea of Sonic Attack comes across in both the inclusion of the track, but also just in the heaviness of the album in general. You know, this one is a lot more chest thumpy and kind of assertive compared to even like some of the stuff on Levitation. This definitely feels harder edged, which, considering all the albums that you mentioned happen in 1981, this feels like it's not trying to be popular. It's trying to do its own thing. You know, there were a few albums definitely that have that more harder edge to it, but not a lot of them. You know, this isn't, at least as for me, a time when that kind of rock is prevalent yet. So I do feel like they're kind of exploring some stuff, even though it does have a much more classic 80s sound for me. It is a lot more aggressive in tone. I like the fact that there seems to be more imagination in it overall. I think, again, that might be Moorcock again. We talked about Levitation being sonically interesting, but being a little bit conceptually bereft, possibly because of the people who had left. The fact that Moorcock's come in, I think, has helped that and made Hawkwind feel a bit more Hawkwindy. There's definitely some tracks which, when they're done, I sit thinking about them a lot more than I did on Levitation. So I'm glad that's back. I do think there's also a couple of tracks where they really go off on one and I'm left thinking, I wasn't expecting that, and you can do that if you want, but I'm not sure I'm going to go with you. So it kind of feels a little bit more like a 70s album in content for me, but it has a very different sound. So yeah, I think this one has been a sideways return to form in a way where it's kind of Hawkwind adjacent from the classic, but is still trying to move it in different ways. And I've had an interesting time with it. I'm not sure it's been the most enjoyable album of theirs that I've listened to recently, but certainly it's one that I've had to really, you know, concentrate and deal with, even in a way compared to like Levitation, which is so good that it kind of washes over you because, like we said before, you kind of put it just into good album territory. Because this one has that kind of like Hawkwind running all over the place, trying to shepherd cats kind of vibe to it, you are left paying much more attention to it.
Yeah, this is an interesting one for sure. This is actually one of the first wave of Hawkwind albums that I got. The RCA era that we're just beginning now was one of the first bits of Hawkwind that I really engaged with, which is probably a sign of its times, because actually there is a movement that's happening now that it almost fits into, not quite, but we're talking about the new wave of British heavy metal that had bands like Iron Maiden and Judas Priest, Diamond Head, you know, I suppose Nazareth might fit in there. Somebody might be annoyed by that, but I think it does. That kind of sound, it's a very muscular album. And I think that paired back more, as you say, chest-thumping feel could also be down to the fact that you are now an album without two of your three Galacticos from Levitation. This is not going to sound like this with Ginger Baker, and it's not going to sound like this with Tim Blake either. But I think it's interesting also that with Levitation was such a musically focused album, this one goes back to being more lyrically focused, and Michael Moorcock has to have a huge amount to do with that, because of course the man is a wordsmith. So this one's going to be an interesting ride. As I say, they used to play this a lot. My brother and I used to play records, and it would be one of his records and then one of mine. And this was one that I would play, that he was quite happy with. He would be playing lots of other records, which is how I now end up liking a lot of the bands that he liked. We swapped a lot of music over, but this is one that he could go with, and this was on the deck quite a lot back in the day. So with that in mind, let's charge on ahead into the title track, Sonic Attack.
So we open on a Hawkwind classic brought into music rather than spoken word this time. And I guess I probably like it more than the spoken word version, but at the same time, I'm also a little bit confused by it. Musically, there's some nice tension to it. You know, it does set a good mood. We have all these looping synthy and guitar kind of soundscapes that work around the vocals that sets this sinister tone. The kick of the track feels like it's ticking time. It kind of reminds me of how the film Dunkirk had the idea of that slow escalation, and like all the percussion was that kind of like tick, 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 like we're running out of time. I felt like the kick kind of just adds that feeling of countdownness or like imminent sonic attack. So I think think they do a good job of adding a little bit of tension around this, you know, is when the drum does a little like tom fill halfway through, you just add that tension, you get like the bass swells at the end. So I think they do a good job of making a audio track for this. I think just the delivery of the vocals makes it hard for me to kind of understand what they were trying to do with this, because the spoken word version somehow felt more like a poem. Therefore, you could see it lots of different ways. You know, you could be like, oh, this is like a PSA, or this is like a warning, or this is someone talking. But the fact that this is almost shouted through what feels like a loudhailer or a bullhorn, delivered like someone barking orders to troops, almost like someone is letting people know in some kind of like street fight what to expect, makes you feel like you're more like in some kind of battle, like you're fighting someone and they might use sonic attacks at you. Therefore, this is just letting you know. So it feels then more sci-fi and less like a kind of a witty allegory that the spoken word one felt more. So it feels somehow less real and more of a like more like a sci-fi idea. And I guess you can obviously then attribute that to reality, but I find it more removed from the quote unquote cleverness of the more spoken word version of it. Some of the delivery also is strange, because like when they say you might start laughing and then the person starts laughing is odd, because I feel like, does that mean he's under sonic attack himself? Is he reminding people what laughter is? I see that you could do that after you say it, but you know, like you might do shouting and then he shouts and says laughter and then starts laughing. It feels then more performative and then less like you're being talked to. And I can see why they did it, because I guess it feels like after you say laughter, why not add to that by laughing? But it's also strange if someone was telling you this is what happens, you then don't do the thing. So it's got some radio play theatricality to it. It's got this feeling of tension, but I don't quite understand its place in the narrative they're setting up. I feel like other things that Hawkwind do, you can imagine the world that you're in, you can imagine the person who's talking, and you get an idea of the context. But I feel for this one, I find it very difficult to place, and therefore it's not a track which I'm a huge fan of, really. On repeat listens that I've been doing, I actually have found myself skipping this one occasionally, because I feel like I've got everything I need from it. And, you know, sometimes I put the album on, then I have to go and do something, or I start walking the dog, assuming that I'm going to get through the whole album, and then he doesn't want to walk, so he comes back, and I only do, like, you know, the first few tracks. I feel like I've listened to this track a lot, and then some of the album less so. So I have started skipping it just to make sure that I got to the other tracks, and I didn't miss it that much. I feel like if there was a way of playing this album, that this track somehow was able to intelligently play itself like every third listen or something, I would enjoy it more. But the fact it's always there is kind of a lot. It's got some Hawkwind vibe to it for sure. It's definitely them. I actually quite like the Help No One Else loop at the end. It kind of just hits this kind of swirl. Again, it reminds me of some of the classic Hawkwind stuff where they do all that kind of repetition stuff. And yeah, I probably prefer this version on the whole to the spoken word one, but I do think that the spoken word one is probably a better use of the subject matter. And this one, by being musical and not quite grounding itself in a way I understand, I feel like the takeaway is less impactful than the previous version.
Yeah, so we come at this slightly differently, because this is a huge, huge favourite of mine. It's worth bearing in mind that, as I said, this was one of the first wave of Hawkwind albums I had. And I had this album quite a long time before I had Space Ritual, which means this was the first Sonic Attack that I heard. And that's kind of interesting because, of course, you're the other way around. You heard the spoken word version from Space Ritual, and we teed this one up. You put it very well, talking about its radio play theatricality. And it reminds me of 1950s radio theatre in that way. And I used to listen to a lot of that working late nights in the early 2000s. And I absolutely love that style of thing. So I love the delivery on this. And I love the music that's going on the backdrop that they've put towards this. You would play this once every two or three just to kind of remind yourself of it. For me, this is one that I would play just on its own, just to go, I need to hear Sonic Attack. So yeah, we're definitely at different ends of the spectrum on this one. Definitely a favorite of mine. And funnily enough, well, actually, not funny at all, really. I remember when we spoke about this, when we did episode 3.5 of Space Ritual, we talked about the fact that back then, in the early 70s, this was a pastiche of duck and cover and protect and survive American and British public service announcements, and beautifully done at that. But when we spoke about that, it felt like a reference that might be lost today. And then it isn't. Suddenly it's a reference which is very much front and center again. And I found that in my head as I would be walking around listening to this, that it had been of its time and then out of time and then suddenly of its time again. That was an interesting realization for me.
I guess for me, it's just, it's not my favorite idea they've ever had. And they're clearly very happy with it, because not only do we have this here, and not only is it the name of the album, and it's also the title track, we've also had it before on the spoken word. We've also had the Brian Blessed version that we've listened to. And as far as I know, they revisit this again and again and again. So I think it's something that I'm just going to have to try to live with, or eventually find the version that they finally do that gets me. What do you get from it in terms of who's saying it or the context or anything, or do you not, and you just enjoy it for what it is?
I think when I first heard it, it was that, A, I loved it musically anyway, and I just like that slightly maniacal delivery that Harvey Bainbridge gives it. But I did like that 50s sci-fi dramatization that it felt like I was attracted to that when I first heard it. Then as I got slightly older, I recognized the social commentary in it. I certainly wasn't old enough to really understand that when I first heard it and thought it was clever. And then whenever they did it live, I loved it. And I've seen some really chaotic versions of Sonic Attack over the years, as I'm sure everybody has. So yeah, it just stuck with me, I think, as it was that crossover between Hawkwind, science fiction, and rock. It was like a perfect coming together of three things that I loved, all producing this thing that I couldn't relate to anything else I'd ever heard. Back in the 80s, I didn't have this when it came out. I probably would have had it, I would say 84, I probably had this. That was when I had this. I hadn't heard some of the more bizarre and experimental music that you and I listen to now. I didn't know any of that existed back then. So this was about the weirdest thing I'd ever heard committed to vinyl. And yeah, I was instantly attracted to it. Probably a lot of the stuff that I like now, I could trace back to those things connecting with me in the same way that this does. So that's where I came from with it. It's interesting you saying that you might have to come to terms with it, because there are a number of different ways that this comes back. And I can tell you that's going to happen sooner than you might expect, Matt, because this is time for our rather dramatic Hawk Binge announcement. And this goes back to a very special shout out here, a post that I would have put in the post bag, except it's from quite a long time ago. And this is Brian Pitkin, who I think is a moderator, maybe even founder of one of the Hawkwind groups on Facebook. I think it's Hawkwind and Related Album History or something like that. And he posted on Facebook, having just burned through Andy Hood's wonderful Hawk Binge podcast twice for good measure, I laughed, I cried, I enjoyed. Do check it out if you have the time. During the Space Ritual episode, episode 3.5, he threatens his co-host Matt Longstaff, the Hawkwind newbie, with the future task of listening to all the released versions of Sonic Attack in an ultimate deathmatch. Matt didn't really get it the first time around, saying, I'm not sure I would call it a track, and calling it suitably weird. That is a hell of a task. He then goes on to say, it doesn't matter who is in the band. When Sonic Attack is on, you know you are in for a treat. There are at least 23 officially released variants, by my count, from the Space Ritual template to the assorted 90s techno rehashes. Uncle Nick's put his mark on the song in the late 90s, giving it a menacing, almost industrial flavor on the Space Ritual 1994 live release, to modern studio takes by Brian Blessed with Hawkwind or William Shatner with Hawkestral. Now, we are indeed going to put you through that hell of a task with the Hawk Binge Sonic Attack Deathmatch. I'm not using the full 23 officially released variants that Brian found, because what we are going to do is run a March Madness-style bracket tournament of versions of Sonic Attack. all of which have a YouTube link. So they are all things that whether you have the vinyl or the CD or what, you're all going to be able to listen to these, to watch these on YouTube. I found the best recordings I could. There are some ones out there which are pretty legendary, but the recordings are dreadful. So these are all decent copies, either from the recording or really good live copies. We've got 16 of them, with as many different types of version and as many different vocalists as I could come up with. So there is indeed Harvey Bainbridge and, of course, Bob Calvert. There's also Nick Turner, as Brian suggested. And, of course, both Brian Blessed and William Shatner. There's also a couple of pretty neat cover versions in there. And there is Dave Brock, because actually on this album, in the re-released extended Atom Hens version that was on CD and that you can get on Spotify and various other streaming services, there is the Dave Brock version of this. So it sounds like they all lined up to have a go at this. And you'd think, given that Michael Moorcock is around and he wrote it and he does vocals on this album, that there would be one of him. This is actually in Carol Clark's book, Saga of Hawkwind. This is the story of what happened to Michael Moorcock's version. Michael Moorcock took Hawkwind up on their early invitation to join in. Sonic Attack was the number he'd performed all those years ago when he first appeared with the band Under the Arches in Ladbroke Grove. His series of introductions to any listener who should chance to come under the dreaded Sonic Attack. He also provided lyrics for Coded Languages, Psychosonia, and Lost Chances. So he's all over this album. The band recorded a new version of Sonic Attack with Moorcock at the microphone, although in the end, they used Harvey Bainbridge's vocals. Moorcock later said, "I just wasn't getting the timing right. If you look at the stuff I did, it was all about sound and language, communication being a personal obsession of his. So that's what my contribution to the album is all about." He also recorded lead vocals for Coded Languages, and this time his performance was included on the album. So, unfortunately, among the 16, there is no Michael Moorcock version. We will be running these polls roughly every 2 or 3 days on any platform where polling is possible. So that's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And the winner of each one-on-one match will progress to the following round to eventually get to a final and a winner of the ultimate Sonic Attack deathmatch and your favorite version of the track. So, Matt, you have 16 versions to get acquainted with and vote on. And the results, A, you'll see them on those social channels, but also we will review at the earliest opportunity, which will be, of course, on our next episode, Church of Hawkwind. So yes, Matt, exciting times. You have a lot of Sonic Attacks to listen to.
A Sonic Attack, if you will.
Indeed.
Like a lot of these things with Hawkwind, I'm sure I definitely infuriate people who like it by always saying I don't get it. I'm not trying to get it. So I'm hoping there's one of these where it could be my gateway Sonic Attack, which will lead me to eventually get it.
Of course, what I'm not going to do is tell everyone what those 16 versions are, because then you would all just look through the list and go, well, that one's better than that one. You will know what they are as they come up on match day. For now, Sonic Attack bleeds out. And we go to a very, very different tone indeed and Rocky Paths.
Isn't it a massive tonal switch? Yeah, the first time I listened to this album, I got the Sonic Attack thing. It kind of finishes on that kind of like bassy almost breath, and it finishes. And then suddenly we're into Rocky Paths, and wow, it does feel like we changed the radio station pretty abruptly. There seems to be even some kind of little synth trill, the very first thing you hear before everything comes in, which sounds like you've just powered up in a video game or something. And even that blip is just enough for you to realize the tone is changing. It reminds me a little bit of Levitation, not in style, but certainly an arrangement, with the idea that they just pound everything in at once, and it's fast, it's upbeat. It reminds me actually of the kind of American melodic skater punk that we got from bands like the Foo Fighters and Goldfinger, that rose to popularity when brands like, you know, Quicksilver and Vans started selling that West Coast anti-authority free spirit lifestyle in malls across the UK when I was growing up. So to hear this in 1981, I was surprised by it, because I hadn't really heard anything like it before the mid 90s for me. So listening to this, I was like, wow, I wasn't expecting that at all. It's quite upbeat. It sounds positive. Even the way that it's sung is very obviously very different because the last track was spoken or shouted, and this one is definitely sung in a kind of long drawl, which goes with the actual like riff itself. It's very energetic but long, you know, so it has that feeling of sustain to it in a kind of more like Motorway City kind of feeling, but like if you were doing 100 miles an hour down Motorway City rather than the more kind of cruising pace that I feel that track has. But it has that same kind of feel. It feels like it's going forward, which is nice. It has this sense of progression to it. Yeah, it just comes in very thick and fast, like Levitation. There's the drums, guitar, bass, everything. Vocal comes in really, really quickly. I feel like it's a different type of Sonic Attack, just in its intensity, but also in its relentless feeling of being kind of positive, which again, you don't always expect from Hawkwind. And maybe you wouldn't expect after something like Sonic Attack, which is obviously very heavy and potentially like politicized and activist led, to suddenly come into this track, which feels very like it could be on the radio in just like a track that you play in a kind of like, you know, positive rock anthems with you all the way through commercial free. If you then played this, you'd be like, yeah, cool, I get it. So yeah, I was surprised. I like it, definitely. The thing that makes it Hawkwind definitely is the playful synth on top of it. Again, just as long and drawn out, if not even more long and drawn out than the guitar. The instrumental B section and like the solo after the lyrics has a lot of fun energy to it as well. I was wondering whether or not this track was a way of them showing that they didn't need the virtuoso musicians in order to shred like this. And we can be technically good and we can be musically interesting. So I was wondering whether or not that was like them trying to prove a point and then kind of moving past it, because this is pretty much the only track on the album that sounds like this. I think the lyrics are a little lazy, but also the track is moving at such a pace. I'm wondering whether or not it's going too fast for poetry. You just need something to fill the space a little bit. I personally would have liked this track to have actually been another 2 minutes longer or something to breathe. I feel like the breakdown could have had a little bit more room. I feel like they could have built it up from the beginning a little bit. You know, it could have taken its time, because I feel like when it finally all comes together, it's very satisfying. And just coming straight at you with it, completely valid way of doing it. But I just feel like it feels like it's trying to impress you or trying to like come at you with so much enthusiasm that is a little poppy, where I feel like if you'd given everything a little bit more room to breathe, it might have felt more like a full track.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. This is actually, back in the day when I said when me and my brother would play this was a favorite of ours. We could play this one over and over, but it definitely stands apart from everything else on the album. It's Hugh Lloyd Langton track. He's the guitarist. He's the singer. Actually, there are four vocalists on this album, three of which you've not heard before. Because I don't think you've heard the voice of Harvey or Hugh singing, or of course, Moorcock later on. You have heard him, of course, on Warrior There's a Time, I suppose. So yeah, it is a different one. And I saw the Lloyd Langton group in Brighton play some years later and play this really well. Also did a great version of psychedelic Warlords Disappearing Smoke when he played live in Brighton as well. So it's definitely a Hugh track, which I think distances it from the tracks that, say, Dave was writing or that Michael Moorcock was involved in, or more group tracks. It very much feels like a Hugh Lloyd Langton track. I think that's probably what you're getting.
Mm, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
But as you said, upbeat, punchy, and, you know, stands out and is a very strong counterpoint to Sonic Attack.
Massively. The one thing that disappoints me on the track is the ending. And I know that it's fading into the new track, but obviously there is a point when the weird spelling out of things that I heard on Robot comes back. And for me, it's because of this track, it's even more unwelcome here, because at least with Robot, it seemed to go with the sinister drudgery kind of thing. And with this, suddenly to have all this weird babbling over it when it's trying to just be like a normal piece of music is kind of a clash. And I like the fact that Hawkwind are starting to look at tracks blending into each other and having more of a journey. Absolutely fine with that. That's cool. I just feel like I would have liked this track to end better so I could listen to it by itself sometime as a finished thought. But now if I do listen to it in isolation, it will always go and then cut. And that's going to be a shame.
There's a compilation album of the RCA years, I can't remember what it's called, but I've actually got it, where Rocky Paths is on its own. And much like Roadhawks gives you Golden Void detached from Assault and Battery, that might work for you. So it's worth looking that version out. But yeah, given that we're on Hawkwind Spell Things Out, which I remember when we did Robot, I pointed out that we would have more of Hawkwind spelling things out. And I'd like a playlist of Hawkwind spelling things out. I think that would be excellent. Where did this take you?
Psychosonia. It's the first probably more conceptual thing we've heard from Hawkwind in a while. So I was wondering, before you said that Moorcock had actually kind of joined the band again, I actually wrote a note to myself saying, had they been fraternizing with writers again? Because this feels like them taking an idea and exploring it musically. Strangely, I just finished rereading Snow Crash over the holidays, over Christmas. And, you know, there's a large theme in that about language being a kind of form of control, and limiting language becomes a protection against the idea of the may, you know, like the power words that can enslave you. I feel like this is exploring a similar kind of idea, but it's also exploring that idea of like doublespeak from 1984, where the removal of words make people less imaginative because they're not able to express themselves or their ideas with the same amount of fidelity as we are. The idea of double plus like instead of love comes to mind. I remember reading that with almost existential horror around the idea of having your mind limited by the amount of ways that you can express thoughts and feelings. It's a terrible prospect. So this kind of speaking in almost sci-fi tongues or kind of babbling at the beginning of the track is kind of annoying, but at the same time, it's making a point because I think it's supposed to be incomprehensible. So even this idea of psychosonia, the name, you know, giving you a clue, is psycho obviously relating to the psyche or the mind, and sonia actually going back to the word wisdom. So the idea of like mind wisdom or psychic wisdom being speech is an interesting idea. So it's a story which for me is a little bit more interesting than Sonic Attack in terms of a thought. I feel like the words are being spoken by some kind of evil overlord who's duping their subjects into silence so they'll be obedient and compliant. It's an interesting little villain piece that they've done before. It's short, it's snappy, but gives you a lot to think about. And like I said, it brought a lot of themes to mind in a very nice, concise way that I think Hawkwind could be really good at. The musical accompaniment is fine. It has a groove to it. I like the fact there's lots of cymbals creating this percussive ring throughout the piece. It's a little basic, but also I think it's probably designed to be that, to just carry the thought rather than get in the way of the thought. You know, like if you weight these tracks, a bit like Sonic Attack, you know, you can either weight it up with the lyrics and the story, or you can weight it musically. In the same way that Rocky Paths, the lyrics are not as complex because the music is there giving you all that emotion, and you couldn't have too much music getting in the way of this idea. So I think this is a really nice complete thought. I actually really quite enjoy it. This for me is Hawkwind getting back to some of their fan favorite pieces, that idea of the sci-fi in here. But there's much more parity in this now than there is to Sonic Attack in a way. And we'll get to that in a later track when they take this idea and run with it a bit more. But that idea of language being changed in order to try to shape people, and propaganda and political speech and that kind of thing, I think right now in the age that we're in now, the information age or the disinformation age, or the people say whatever the hell they want, and what is truth age, we're almost trying to figure that out again. I feel like this is much more poignant now than maybe it even was when they made it. So this is a nice track, and for me is one of the ones that really caught my attention about this album when I first heard it.
Yeah, and, you know, we just heard that quote from Michael Moorcock in The Saga of Hawkwind, where he talks about his obsession being language and control through language. So this is really Michael Moorcock stepping into the wordsmithery void left behind by Bob Calvert. Because certainly, you know, the other lyrics, particularly, say, on Levitation, didn't have this kind of bite to them. And there is a lot of social commentary on this. This is probably the most social commentary packed album I can think of them doing. It also goes back to a comment from Michael Moorcock that I remember when we were talking about Hall of the Mountain Grill and the psychedelic warlords Disappear in Smoke, which was again another social commentary song. And Michael Moorcock talking about Hawkwind being at their best when they're talking about the city. And there's a lot of that through this album. I used to be slightly irritated waiting for the Hawkwind spelling things out to stop, because I really love the bit where Harvey Bainbridge shouts, you know, silence, and then that thing kicks in. And I love that moment. Now I understand more about the tension and the release of tension. I quite enjoy getting slightly irritated while that goes on and on and on, because it just ratchets up that tension ready for that massive release when that comes in. And I do love that part of the track. So yeah, this is one that I think I probably appreciate more now than I did at the time. And, you know, again, very muscular track on the rhythm side, very, very punchy, heavy stuff. They were touring, I remember, with bands that were in the pages of Kerrang routinely, Crocus, Mama's Boys, that kind of thing. So this is Hawkwind probably at their heaviest at this point, which was something, again, I would have found quite attractive. The spacier, jazzier elements, I think, are things that I got into later on. So, yeah, this one worked for me.
They get a lot of energy out of the bass notes, just playing one note, but da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, that carries a lot of energy through it. And again, it's a great way of making a bed over this much more, again, spoken word. It's just funny that of the two songs to put next to each other, this very upbeat Rocky Pass mixing with this, which again is like, you know, darker, driving, sinister story. It feels like those two things shouldn't go together. And I guess marrying them with that strange Hawkwind Tower of Babel kind of thing is a way of doing it. But I just feel like the arrangement is strange there. I don't know why this track isn't further down or why they didn't maybe lean into this a little bit more and why that positive track for track two is there.
It feels very deliberate to throw you off with the big left turns rather than continue a theme and make a little sweet out of it, but to keep going away from it, coming back to it, which again they do because you get the very different sounding version of the world up next.
Yeah, because I always thought the Psychosonia ended strangely with this kind of defeated bass sigh at the end, but it also needed to end in silence for the next track to work. You end on this silence, which just allows Virgin of the World to just creep in. And what a track Virgin of the World is for me. This feels like Hawkwind doing what Hawkwind know they can do. And every single time they do something like this, it's always just done so nicely and so differently as well. You know, I feel like, am I ever going to get tired of these? And right now, with Virgin of the World, I certainly am not. I thought, maybe until this track, that the synths had taken a bit of a back foot from the very guitar-heavy work. I mean, they're obviously there, but in this track, they're really brought to the fore, and they just build this really beautiful, evocative audio sea that I feel like the guitar can skip along the surface of. So the tables are turned, and instead of the synth being something that helps pick out the guitar riffs, now we have a gorgeous synthscape that the guitar just picks its way through like it's a little audio explorer going through this world, which is just helping us move forward with the piece. I love the looped layers, the fact that they work at different speeds. You have that one almost arpeggio, which is going up and down very fast. You then have much more of a bed layer, which is really slow. And then in the middle is another little synth loop. And the fact that they all undulate around each other, it just allows you to pick them out as they move in and out of this landscape that they're making. So I think that's really, really nice. And then the lyrics, when they come in, are great for me in both content and delivery. This is a really nice, very simple, but very poetic bit of writing for them. It's like three lines, but it's all you need. I love the effects on the vocals. I love the whispering. I love the delicateness of the whole thing.
When I was listening to this back in the day, I never skipped this, but I never really got much out of it because I'd enjoyed the previous three tracks a lot. And then this one felt like a little bit of a roadblock to me. Now, having heard so much more electronic music, this is something that I quite enjoy now. I wouldn't say it's as much of a highlight for me as it is for you. And strangely, given all of the commentary that's been going on and what is yet to come, again, it feels like a track, lyrically at least, which is almost out of place in the album. The album feels like such a streets album or a current album. And then suddenly you have this track about spacefaring, undead, whatever. It is beautiful, though, and the effects on the voice is great, and I do like the music. But it's interesting how thematically it stands out to me in the album. But, you know, in a way that I'm perfectly happy with now than I was back when I was first listening to the album. So that's one of those things where I've come back to with a very different attitude, I think, than the one I had before.
Yeah, I guess maybe it just speaks to me a bit more as well in what I like in general in terms of, you know, synthscapes and that kind of thing. I'm a fan of those. I also feel like this might be the first time that the synths feel like they're played well. Not that they're not played well in the other tracks, but they feel a bit simple. And I guess the fact that the synth player left and wasn't replaced, even like with Sonic Attack, I feel like the chords feel a bit stabby and not like played well. And I feel like the synth hasn't really been calibrated well. It feels a little bit basic, a little bit flat. But then for this to be there, makes you still feel like they pay attention to that as an instrument. So it's kind of interesting that this is the one that gives me that faith.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, without Tim Blake, neither of Harvey or Dave is going to dash off the kind of maestro keyboard solo that Tim Blake would do. The days of Space Chase are gone with that person leaving the room. And I think that also, you look back at, say, Simon House, who was classically trained, and you've got that kind of build-up and those layers, the kind of wall of sound that Simon could bring to tracks. I think with Dave and Harvey, they've been experimenting and getting more and more into these. But it's where you probably see more use of loops and sequences coming to the fore with Hawkwind, which really does underpin a lot of what comes after and play to really, really good effect here. And again, quite the contrast to the single, Angels of Death.
Yeah, I mean, Virgin of the World, the way it peters out, and again, you just have that very fast loop, which carries us into the next track perfectly and makes it, again, feel like this is the second two-part song in the album that we've had thus far. I think actually, when I was first listening to this and wasn't looking at the track listing, I was wondering if Virgin of the World and Angels of Death were actually the same track, and this just was a cut. I think just because of the subject matter as well, the idea of being undead and then being angels of death, I think it makes sense that these two go back to back. There is a uniting theme. But compared to Rocky Paths, which comes in guns blazing in that positive riff loop, Angels of Death dropping into the riff, I think, is really good. I think maybe just because there's a little less of it, but it's just a great riff, great drums coming in. For me, that's a great drop. I love the filtered bass. You hear it, and then it comes down to fill out the bottom end of the track. It sounds a little bit like Hawkwind are channeling Dire Straits or something here. Like, oh, there's something like...
We've just lost half our listeners.
I don't know, but there's something about just the way that they're playing it reminds me of a Dire Straits record or something. It just feels different to what they've normally done, and definitely different to what they've been doing thus far. But, you know, like Rocky Paths, they've got this harder rock with pleasing key change thing down pat. It feels really well done. I like this one a lot. But yeah, there's something about the way that the riff is played and put together feels like other bands somehow. Or maybe that's just 80s-ness creeping in, and that's just the reference I have because that was a record that I know my dad had when I was growing up. But there's something about it with a dun 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 dun, and then there's a chord which bangs through every fourth beat. For me, it's evocative of a style, if not another band.
Definitely struggling slightly with the Dire Straits thing, but it's now in my head to sing Angels of Death, but substitute Sultans of Swing, and vice versa. That will probably be something that's quite hard to get out of my head now I've put it in.
Sorry about that.
No worries. It's amusing. So... yeah, can't help thinking that there'll be some opinions. We'll see. You might be very right, I guess, and maybe I don't know Dire Straits very well. So, yeah, it is different. It does feel to me like a straight down the line hard rock song. I do really like Dave's delivery. He's got real bite in the lines when he delivers Angels of Death, and he sounds like he's having a wicked good time belting it out. And it did become something of a live favorite. So yeah, Angels of Death is something, again, I think I've grown into. It wasn't one of my favorite tracks. I liked it well enough, but it felt a little bit like filler when I first heard it. Mm. And it's coming back to it that I appreciate it slightly more for what it is. And yeah, so a good one. Not my favorite still, but definitely something I'm quite happy to hear. And as you say, it's a very strong riff.
Yeah, it was nice to hear Dave. This is the first time we've heard him on the album, apart from, like, you know, saying random words on the previous track. He does do a very good rendition of this. It feels good. I don't know if anyone else would have been able to do this compared to anyone else that they've got. So, yeah, I think that was good. You're right. It is a good hard rock track. I think the solo is a little whatever, but actually the solo being a little bit lackluster gave me a chance to really appreciate what's holding that solo up, which is that big textured full bottom end section, which has lots of tactile strumminess and that very 80s sounding kick and snare rhythm with these really nice clear hi-hats that kind of tick, tick, tick their way through. I really like the detailing in that. For me, that's just some really nice recording and some nice mixing. So I do feel like the texture through the entire audio spectrum of this track is really nicely done. So whatever engineer they had on this track has done a very good job. I feel like this is the second time that Hawkwind have made a song for the fans. like Sonic Attack, you know, this one talks about space. It's got strange sci-fi themes, callback to Warriors on the Edge of Time, even ideas of urban violence and unrest, just updated for this tougher sound and 80s production. So when I said at the beginning, I feel like this is Hawkwind going back to the fans with an album. This for me is very much that kind of track. Again, I feel like the rhyming's a little basic, you know, while and smile, space and race, dead and lead. It's fine. But again, the music aggressiveness of it isn't asking a lot for the cerebral input. So I feel like I notice it when it's not there, especially when we've started to get interesting things like the poem of Virgin of the World and this idea of psychosonia that I know they can still do it. So I notice it when it's not there, but also this track doesn't particularly warrant it. That said, "We were born to erase all of your days" is a great line. So it makes up for it at the end.
Yeah, there's no grimace going on in this track, at least.
There is not.
So yeah. So it's a strong, strong end to side one. I think side one's been a pretty eclectic and strong side as just, you know, taken as a whole. So we flip over the vinyl and we kick off side two with a bit more street level social commentary, "Living on a Knife Edge."
Which makes me feel like Hawkwind are now channeling the Ramones.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Okay, an agreement that time. Great.
Yeah, you know, you could have come in with like Earth, Wind and Fire or something. You were given the Dire Straits. I didn't know what you were going to bring to that.
This is kind of punk light for me. I don't like the start of it. The fade in of the track as it's already in full swing is a bit of a vibe killer, especially as Hawkwind has been so good at doing tracks that start well in this album. The fact that this one just fades in is a bit of a shame. If you're listening to it all the way through, like on a streamer, it's a real vibe killer. I would like it to have started properly, like with a drum fill and in or something. But whatever. Then you have this kind of punk light feel where the lyrical content is very anti-authority, but the music the lyrics live in is kind of soft. It is a little bit for me like if you took all the teeth out of Blitzkrieg Bop, you'd get this kind of sound. And I think it's weird that they are doing this kind of arrangement, but not having the distortion really and not having the grit of the track. It's all very, very soft and very kind of low and doesn't seem to have that anger or energy. It's all very muted. And so it takes for me a little bit out of the power of the vocals because the vocals are really Hawkwindy. You know, there is a clear swipe at surveillance culture and, you know, what the band sees as a clear overstep by the government into the privacy of the individual. And again, there's something quite nice in Hawkwind here about that thing I've said before about the banality of the bureaucracy that they bring in, you know, the idea of freezing forms and that kind of thing. Here they say, you know, duplicate forms and ID cards, the forms are back. And it's not that dramatically sinister, but it's just lame, but lame in that officious way, you know, like somehow the fact that they call that out again just gives you that idea that this system has been set up to deal with all of this. And no one involved in the setting up of that system ever said, hang on, is this a bit creepy what we're doing? Because yeah, they've got duplicate forms and things signed in triplicate. So it's that kind of banality of human oppression and spying, which is always funny when Hawkwind do it.
Yeah, it reminds me of the film Brazil, because that's the nature of the evil, if you like, in Brazil, as the complete corporatization and blandness and bureaucratization. That's the word I was looking for. It's that endless, endless bureaucracy, which is all aimed at denying you various freedoms. And given that this track is 40 years old, it speaks to today just as much as it spoke to 1981, you know, no doubt. In fact, coming back to the album after quite a long time, obviously I've heard it a lot in the last couple of months and we've been prepping this. But I hadn't really heard it, not really listened to it for quite a long time. It feels like an album written in 1981 about 2021 on a number of different levels, not just this track. We'll get to more. And I guess that doesn't necessarily mean, wow, Hawkwind, they really nailed it. Aren't they prescient? It just means we really haven't moved forward at all. And he always speaks to that, doesn't he? Because you get future generations are relying on us and you think, yeah. Yeah, that didn't pan out, did it?
You're right. But that's interesting because it's one of the first times I've noticed Hawkwind do more than just notice things around them. and actually have a pretty clear message of future generations are relying on us. It feels like a call to action where before they've never really had a call to action. They've said this is going on and they've had opinions like this sucks, but they've never really got this far into what are you going to do about it? You know, they've never taken that extra step. And this time it actually feels like they kind of do. I also think that rhyming a relying on us with Incubus is interesting because I actually knew this, but I did double check it. But traditionally, an incubus is a type of demon that would sneak into the bedrooms of sleeping women and sexually assault them. So I kind of like the idea of it's a world we've made. Incubus kind of sounds like the band are implying that we've created something that's going to screw us eventually while we're not looking. So I think that's a very imaginative way of actually making that point, which again, for me, is peak Hawkwind. And again, that's probably very more cocky in that kind of way.
It's interesting, right? Because the way you read it is the way I read it. At first, I didn't read that way. At first, I thought, wow, that's a really random word to throw in there. What on earth is that word doing in that track? Then I came to a kind of conclusion a bit like you. Then I thought I'd look up the word. And the word has two meanings. One, a male demon believed to have sexual intercourse with sleeping women. However, also a cause of difficulty or anxiety. So in that case, actually linguistically rather clever. It's a world we made, incubus. So I suspect somebody did know that incubus actually meant a cause of anxiety or difficulty, and it's used it in that context. But it's not a word I would use in that context and expect other people to recognize it, because it feels like popular culture has it that it's the more demon version of the word that people would think of when they hear it. But nevertheless, it's a good lyric.
Also, I think because I assume that Moorcock wrote this, I just assume that he'd go for the sex angle because that seems to be his MO.
But yeah, I really like this track. Again, as you say, it's nowhere near as heavy and rough and edgy musically, but I do love the lyrical content. And it's like listening to Hawkwind of the Calvert era, where I was more focusing on the words a lot of the time. And I kind of remember this, and it's a surprise to do that on a track that Dave is singing. But yeah, it's a good start.
The end of the track's strange as well, because by the end of the track, it's actually eschewed any punk sensibilities. It actually goes quite soft and it's almost another track. But I do like the repeat of living on a knife edge, looking for the ground, because I like this kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. I see it as they're in a uncomfortable and risky situation and they're looking for a way to jump off of it safely. But if the ground isn't visible, it's still just as big a risk to jump. So they're staying put, but they're still keeping an eye out for a chance to escape. I do like that thought as well as a way of finishing it. This track is a strange journey, but it does stick the landing nicely and just has a little fade out, which is perfectly fine, way better than their fade in.
Yes, absolutely. Which takes us to something we've referred to already, which is Coded Languages, featuring the one and only Michael Moorcock. And before I get your take on this, Matt, there's a nice bit here written by Ian Abrahams in Sonic Assassins about Michael Moorcock and his lyrical and vocal contribution to the album. He says, Sonic Attack overcame the lack of a principal songwriter by leaning on written contributions from Michael Moorcock. As always with Hawkwind, I was asked by Dave to come back when things weren't working out with Bob, says Moorcock. But it wasn't just his use of language that Moorcock brought to Sonic Attack, but his imposing vocal ability as well. At Rockfield, Moorcock cut a version of the title track, which was eventually rejected by Brock in favor of the take with Bainbridge providing the vocals. But Moorcock did lend his idiosyncratic Johnny Rotten meets opera voice to Coded Languages. Michael arrived with a batch of lyrics for us to use. We kind of fiddled around with them, says Bainbridge. Michael heard me going around with the sequence and said, I've got something. I asked him if he would sing the song, but he didn't want to at first. But when he did record the vocal track, it was great. Out of this collaboration came much that was interesting on Sonic Attack and some lyrics that were used for later RCA album, Choose Your Masks. So Matt, Coded Languages.
This is, I don't even know where I start with this track. I mean, it's possible I dislike this track more than Flying Doctor.
Wow.
Yeah. Although it's annoying because it's a fiercely intelligent song that is delivered in a way which I just can't deal with. Following on from the previous track, where we've just had this hint at a call to action, this track comes out swinging with the "question the nature of your orders" repeated line, you know, which again is even further towards a real like challenge to Hawkwind to disrupt, which is interesting for sure. And when I first listened to this track, I assumed that the intro was another little Hawkwind track, you know, like another little like minute thing, because the main part of the track just then crashes in out of nowhere. But nope, that's how that track works. And in comes Moorcock with this kind of slurry, seedy way of singing, which actually I'd written Johnny Rotten-esque down in my notes as well. But I just find it really irritating. I don't enjoy it. I find it overperformative, obnoxious, unhelpful, flying doctor-like in terms of that dumb accent kind of thing. And it's annoying that it's trying to tell an interesting story in a way which I find hard to then credit. For me, it's the musical equivalent of Russell Brand. Like, I'm pretty sure that guy has some useful things to say, but because he does it in a way which is so damn annoying, I find it hard to agree with him. And I feel like this track has the same kind of problem. Like, it's got some great stuff, like built on that idea of psychosonia, the idea of words, lines like "words are weapons of their will, their words can hurt, their words can kill, a burning phrase can burn a town, a syllable can bring you down." They're great lyrics. And if you look at the lyric sheet, this is a lyric dense song. You know, it's not just like a little thought which is repeated or like said and then there's a big instrumental bit. This is a whole song. It's a rant. It's an incoherent shouting rant, the kind of thing that you'd find on the most drunkest days of Speaker's Corner in London. Just for me, it's way too much. I just find it like irritatingly presented, but also intelligently done. So it's one of those things where I find I'm stuck at both hating and admiring it at the same time. Even stuff like "language is encoded, language is eroded," and then that turns into nonsense again. That's kind of the point, because he's eroding language. But a bit like the babble stuff at the start of Psychosonia, you know, it's just annoying to hear, even if it's clever and fits within the piece. I do like it as a jab at political speech. You know, the whole point of this actually reminds me of an essay that George Carlin wrote about language, where he talked about how in the Vietnam War, people got shell shock. And shell shock sounds bad, you know, like you wouldn't want to get shell shock. And you feel like if a soldier got shell shock, the government should probably help them out because that sounds terrible. But then because of that, when you got into like the war in Afghanistan and Iraq and that kind of thing, you know, shell shock turned into battle fatigue, which sounds suddenly softer and therefore less harmful. And eventually it became post-traumatic stress disorder, which sounds less visceral and just more boring and bureaucratic. And now it's just PTSD, which doesn't mean anything. All the emotion and viscerality is gone. And now the government doesn't pay anyone for shell shock because they've been able to soften that out of a feeling of viscerality. One line I really like is "makes you slaves to fancy words and phrases until you're pushing up the daisies." That's actually delivered really nicely. I like that. And that's a great line because I feel like it's that idea that political speech or clever language can be used in order to completely change the meaning or the effect of things. And again, like we said, this is really poignant right now, that idea of people dismissing truth as fake news or people making up alternative facts in order to try and push a narrative that they want and all that kind of stuff.
When is an invasion a military operation, for example?
Right, exactly. All that kind of stuff. And you see it and you know it's happening, but because someone's using a different word, it's hard to have that fight. So I completely agree with all of this. I just, yeah, really wish it was performed by someone else because I just can't with this track most of the time.
I've come a long way with this track. And obviously, it's very, very different for me to listen to this, having been prepared for 30 odd years to hear this voice do it. I was interested in what would happen when this comes at you for the first time, because I didn't really get it. I didn't like it when I first heard it, the voice. I was expecting someone to sing the song and I wasn't ready for that. I wasn't a punk. I was too young for it and I didn't really get it. And when I heard it, this is the most angry Hawkwind song of all time, I think. Like, blatantly raging song. As you said, the lyrics are astounding. The writing is beautiful in here. I love the cleverness of it, but the bite of it as well. But weirdly, the rage in it affected me less when I was hearing it, when I wasn't particularly angry myself, which I wasn't really. I wasn't the most politically savvy and I wasn't particularly angry growing up. That's something that's hit me in later life. My brother was very different. He was very, very socially aware, very angry most of the time. I was listening to King Crimson, Genesis, Frank Zappa. He was listening, also listening to Frank Zappa, but he would be listening to The Specials and punk and ska and all this kind of thing, which is a very, very different thing. Now, coming back to this album, having gone through everything that we've gone through since, say, 2016, which takes me back to the lyric in Living on a Knife Edge of future generations relying on us and kind of going, wow, we made a pig's ear of that. And then the kind of anger and frustration that comes out when you think about what's happened in the last 6 years, I find that my state of mind begins to be very complementary to Moorcock's state of mind and his rather maniacal ranting with that particular music that's going on and those words and what's going on in the world. The whole thing comes together and weirdly works for me now in a way that it didn't used to. When I understood less and I was more interested in the music, and because musically it's very, very abrasive, it's someone just belting it out. As you very accurately put it, I've found that I've moved towards it and now thoroughly enjoy it in a way that I was unable to do until this particular round of listening to the album. So I've come around kind of full circle with Coded Languages to a point where it's one of those that I really like now. But I totally, totally understand where you're coming from, because I've taken a number of years to grow into that and you've just heard it for the first time. And I think, yeah, it's a bit of a punch in the face.
It's also, I just think growing up with a largely instrumental sensibility, my choice of vocalists is quite particular. So I'm very much aware that this could just be my problem. Again, just looking at my record collection, probably with the exception of maybe System of a Down, there aren't many overly flamboyant singers in my collection or things that I would listen to that have vocals. A lot of my vocals that I like are fairly straight deliveries. I mean, Flair, for sure. I mean, things like London Grammar, I love her voice. I think that's spectacular. But for me, that's haunting and beautiful and not overly performative, theatrical and weird, which is, you know, a lot of what Hawkwind do, which I find challenging. I'm going to work on this a little bit. I'm going to stay with it and see if I can get to it, because I like the content, as we said. I like all that kind of stuff. I just find, yeah, the delivery is difficult. It feels a little bit, again, like when you see like protests for things, where I feel like the protest is completely valid, but half the protesters look like the kind of people who the people who are looking at the protest would immediately dismiss.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is a great track that should be heard by people, but the delivery means that the people that should hear it aren't going to.
Yeah.
And so that always frustrates me slightly. Like I can imagine, like, you know, imagine if there was like an anti-war march in London with 1,000 people marching in silence in suits, compared to someone who's stripped to the waist, covered in blue paint with a whistle. It's just different. And I just feel like this track is more in that kind of way, which will stir up a certain type of people. But those people, unfortunately, like we've seen with Days of the Underground, it feels like those are the people that won't start the revolution or won't be able to realize the revolution. So, you know, it's just one of those things which I find difficult to pass, you know, where I feel like I'd like this to succeed. And I don't think it's setting itself up for success.
Yeah, I find it hard to believe at any point that Hawkwind are not preaching to the converted with all of these messages, simply because probably if you said, I like Hawkwind, politically, that probably says all anyone needs to know about you. I was talking to someone, interestingly, about this. It was a brand strategy discussion, and people were talking about brands and how brands have purposes and how people identify with brands. And I'd never clocked this before, but I pointed out that when I was young, people identified themselves through bands. Through band t-shirts. And you would see someone wearing a band t-shirt and it told you pretty much everything you really needed to know. And I was reminded of that when not too long ago, there was the EDL, English Defence League, something. They had a big march or rally or something in, I think it was Birmingham. And there was a woman called Safia Khan who faced off with the guy who was leading the EDL and clearly won the moment, basically. And she's wearing a Specials t-shirt. And it harkened back to that time when you go, yeah, of course she is. But so it was interesting how bands have largely been replaced by brands, because I don't think big bands tend to have that kind of label anymore. Hawkwind probably do. Like, you know, anyone you see wearing a Hawkwind t-shirt, you don't need to go trawling through their social profiles and recording all their data to know a fair bit about them, I would say. And that's your point, really. They're raging, but raging to people who would expect them to rage about things they'd expect them to rage about. But, you know, what can you do, I suppose? You've got your audience and you've got your means of creative expression and you run with it.
No, of course, if you're a pitchfork salesman, it's best to find an angry mob rather than create one. I get that.
Which leads us neatly onto disintegration.
Yeah, which is probably one of the better little things that Hawkwind have thrown into an album. For me, this feels like a companion piece to Infinity from PXR5 somehow.
Yeah, good shout.
It could be the imprisoned victim from Infinity that's finally reached their point of entropy and their suffering is finally at an end. Because the delivery of the line sounds kind of like they're fine with it. You know, they're not like, oh, am I going to disintegrate and that sucks? It's kind of like, oh, will this finally happen? So I was thinking about, well, who might say that? And then I was thinking of, well, that person who was stuck in Infinity from an evil trap is probably, after quite some time, quite looking for their release. So I feel like these two back to back in the same delivery, even in that kind of wistful way, is a nice little thing. So, yeah.
Same, really. The link to Infinity is something I hadn't thought of before, but now you say it, yeah, I think that's it's a pretty good shout. It does have that same kind of sonic palette to it. Yep, go with that. Not much more to add there. And then Streets of Fear, which does not start with a fade-in.
It does not. It starts with a great drum beat, though. This is like that 80s kick, snare, ground pound kind of thing that 80s drum kits are very good at producing, and studio engineers are very good at bringing out that kind of thwack that you get from the snares. Again, possibly another strange connection that I made that you may or may not agree with, but for me, this musically reminds me of like a staccato Magnu. The way that this works and the way that the notes change, mm-hmm. I feel like I can sing Magnu over the top of it, which is not a problem. But I just, again, just heard that
show.
And was like, oh, yeah. Was that another throwback to the fans a little bit? This, again, has this dystopian, ruined city, cyberpunk gang vibe to it. The idea of a lawless city ruled by the strongest who do whatever they want with impunity is always a haunting prospect. And, you know, it's the theme of many a thriller. I actually looked kind of on a whim, but Escape from New York came out in 1981. And I was wondering whether or not stories or films of that kind of style worked with this. Because, you know, that idea of a city which is, you know, like has been reduced to complete lawlessness and crime. It's got that kind of Judge Dredd, Mega City 1 feeling to it. It's weird because the lyrics are kind of almost delivered by the head badass of the city. But with this kick and snare beat, it's very catchy. And actually, it's very, I can't listen to this and not move around a bit. You know, it's very bouncy, despite the darkness of the content, which I always think is funny. It's just like, I'm being threatened by this guy, but I'm kind of like fine with it. Kind of like moving my head around as they say all the bad things that they could do to me.
It's a groovy kind of oppression.
Very groovy. Exactly. Groovy Oppression would be a great name for something.
It's our first album. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I never really made the science fiction or future leap with this. This was always, to me, was talking about the present and not really through allegory either. It was just talking straight to the present. But I may be mistaken there. That could be me getting carried away with the fact there's so much social commentary on the album. But that's how I took this. But everybody can take the songs as it comes to them, really. So there's nothing bad about that. I never really liked the riff in this. I was always slightly annoyed by the riff. And it's quite funny because I'm not annoyed by the riff in Magnu. But now you've said it, I can see how similar those things are. And yes, you can do the same vocals over the top. Yeah, so I don't mind it. But of the rock tracks on the album, it's probably my least favorite. I like the lyrics. I thought lyric content's good. I think Dave's delivery is good. But yeah, musically, didn't do quite so much for me. I'm quite glad that it's not the last track on the album for that reason.
Yeah, because it does end quite unsatisfactorily by just doing its kind of fade, which is a shame. I was also expecting the lyrics to return for one last go, but they do the lyrics and then they have that kind of breakdown and then they don't come back and kind of it calls it a day, which is, you know, in a complete contrast to something like Coded Language, which, you know, it's like, I've got a lot to say and you're going to listen to all of it. This is just kind of like, here, story, music, done. Cool, fine, great. But essentially more of a one-liner than a full story by the end of it.
Yeah, exactly. I think when I was first listening to this album, and through the years I've heard it, I thought of this in much the same way as I thought of Angels of Death. But now I've warmed very much to Angels of Death, and I haven't massively warmed to this one. So I don't dislike it particularly, but it would definitely be more in the average end of the scale for me, for Hawkwind generally, not just for the album.
I quite like the synth in the breakdown.
Yep.
That feels like a quite 80s synth to it, almost kind of Game Boy buzz to it somehow, which I which I quite like as a little highlight in it. But yeah, I think for me, that's the highlight of a fairly standard groove. And like you said, a pretty like middle of the road track, but I don't mind it when it's around. When it's gone, I'm also fine, you know, but yeah. I like the drums.
Yep. Yeah. Drums are cool. And that takes us to the final track on the album, which I'm sure, annoyingly enough, does indeed fade in, the rallying cry that is Lost Chances.
Yeah, once again, we just fade in like in medias res, which, especially for the last track, doesn't make me feel like the album is going to conclude particularly satisfyingly. Fortunately, I think it kind of does, actually. It ends better than the start sounds like it will be. But a bit like PXR5, I feel like the lyrics are a little on the nose and lack that wonderful way that Hawkwind can dance around a subject and let you walk yourself into the point that they're making. This feels very like, this is it and we're going to tell you some things. It's kind of a Hawkwind morality story about reaping what you sow, you know, and how your mistakes stick to you after you've made them. I do quite like the line, there are ghosts in our lives that will not fade until we've paid, because I do think that is very true. But again, for me, that is the line that I would have tried to build the track around rather than more heavy-handed with the other analogies of time disintegrating things and then you still having all this guilt and that kind of thing. I think it's okay. A bit like PXR5, it's there. I see that they've got this concluding thought in that let's have a takeaway message, like the end of a G.I. Joe episode or something, which is fine. But I do feel like with Spirit of the Underground, they can nail that a lot better than they have here. I don't particularly feel like it really sticks the landing. For me, actually, after I listened to it a few times, I played it once from about 2:40 in from the start of the breakdown. And if you start it there and then finish it sooner, for me, it's a much better track because it removes a lot of the bits I don't like, starts on a much more mystical way, starts with the line, there are ghosts in our lives, and then finishes. For me, that's a much better track. So in my brain, I edit almost the first 3 minutes and I get a much more satisfying track, you know, which has that fast paced jam, washes out at the end with that little glittering synth riff into this low echoing drone, and we're out.
Interesting. I'll have to give that a go. I hadn't thought of that before. I'm quite happy for the album to end on this track. It's higher up for me than Streets of Fear. And as you say, lyrically, it is very obvious. There isn't really kind of storytelling, metaphor and allegory going on, which means I suspect this is, I could be wrong, but this probably isn't one of those tracks that Moorcock has fed an awful lot into, I would imagine. And yeah, brings the second half and therefore the album as a whole to a close. A slightly patchier side two, I would say, compared to side one. But on the whole, a good, solid, hard rock album.
Yeah, I think on balance, looking at everything we've got here, we've had Levitation, which was pushing things in new ways, but pushed us further away from, I feel like, what Hawkwind is a little bit. Although, you know, there were some nice tracks on there for sure, but they were different. This is them dragging themselves back to maybe a bit more like center of the road for them rather than veering off. And as an album, I think that needed to happen. I would assume that this was quite good at regalvanizing their fan base. And as we're going through this, you know, chronologically and seeing this as a kind of milestone, I think this album needed to happen to exist for maybe another jumping off point where they try and go in a more forward direction rather than kind of veering like they did for Levitation. And I'm hoping now that maybe they're a little bit more grounded in people, they're grounded in record label, there's maybe fewer things where they're like, oh God, we just grab some people and do a thing, and there's less desperation and maybe a bit more purpose. I feel like I didn't connect with this album anywhere near like I did Levitation. Listening to this was more of a chore than I think any Hawkwind album has been for me, actually.
Right.
For whatever reason. Maybe it's the sound, maybe it's just the content, it's everything. But I'm now actually quite interested to see where they go from here. I think they needed to do this to collect themselves, and I needed to hear this to feel like they were back. And now whatever they do next, I'm hoping I can listen to from a more of a position of comfort. Because if you removed this album and then jumped straight to Church, which I haven't listened to yet, but I could imagine that going from Levitation to Church without this in the middle might actually be harder work. We'll see. I will let you know whether or not I agree with that, but I'm just putting that out there.
So that is the music of Song Attack. Let's take a look at the cover. It looks like an album where there's almost two versions of a front cover, basically, and they've just decided which one goes where. It's designed by Jim Mountjoy and Andrew Christian, and apparently Jim Mountjoy was the illustrator and Andrew Christian was the art director. Don't know much about either of those guys, so I'm not sure what else they've done, but fairly striking imagery.
Yes, it's very, tell me your album is from the 80s without telling me your album is from the 80s, isn't it?
Like, it is, rather.
Especially the one on the back, like that font is the most 80s thing you can really see. I think the 80s is such a difficult time. I was born in 84, so I guess I was more of a 90s child, but I definitely got a fair amount of 80s in me. And so seeing all this now looks so of a time. And the 80s was so pleased with itself, especially when it comes to art and film and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, they had these new toys. They had CGI for the first time. They had computers that could start to do things. They had illustrated tools like this. I feel like there was this amazingly unself-aware, beautiful, reckless abandon that the 80s had, where just everything can be done. Everything was big. Everything was crazy. You know, even like the, you know, cereal commercials from the 80s are absolutely insane. You know, they're just like, yeah. Like, why did we hit peak advertising for cereal? But, you know, like something that just is innocuous that you buy for a couple of pounds off an aisle suddenly became, you know, mascots and animations and explosions and craziness. And like, this feels like it has some of that, you know, it's got electricity and power. And I actually think personally, I prefer the back cover. I think it's just a little less unencumbered by thought, insofar as you have one hawk, which is looking at you with transformery Gundam eyes, which feels very Hawkwind. You know, like the idea of a robot hawk or metallic hawk seems cool to me. Its wings stretch up to the logo, which is encased nicely in this big lozenge. That idea of the colors going through the metal, Sonic Attack is nicely placed. If you drop that down and remove the names of the tracks and credits and everything and just left that there, I think that'd be really nice. I think the other main front cover looks a little bit like a child's toy. I feel like the hawk has wings, which also has hawk heads, which then has this more crackly font, which has lightning coming out of it. And the bird is much more emblematic. And then Sonic Attack is in this horrible font that looks like it's trying to be Shinobi Enter the Dragon or something. I just feel like there's too many ideas. It's like, stop designing. You're fine. You got there. Wind some of this back.
It's funny, isn't it? Because the front cover of Sonic Attack has become quite iconic, but I'm kind of with you. I look at it now and all of the lightning and the big lightning crack is very metal. You know, you should be making the sign of the horns at that. And Hawkwind is written in kind of a spiky, lightning-y font. The whole thing feels to me like it is aiming at a metal crowd. The music isn't metal. It's got high, it's heavy. It's got a hard rock sound to it. But the album cover feels to me like it is aiming quite squarely at a very metallic audience. Unfortunately, the two lightning strikes with the wings outside them, it looks very reminiscent of the Van Halen logo. Obviously, this is well before Van Halen, but I'm not particularly a fan of Van Halen, so that slightly irritates me now. Whereas the back doesn't quite align itself quite so squarely with the genre. It feels like it's a bit more Hawkwind. It's not Hawkwind being something else other than Hawkwind. And as you say, Sonic Attack is better on the second side. To me, you can tell that this was a candidate for the front cover because of the fact that it has Hawkwind in a completely different font and it has the name of the band and the album title. Most album covers, the back of the cover is very obviously the back of the cover. Whereas there are Hawkwind albums where they've just seemed to have asked for some artwork and some artwork's come in. And they're not really sure. So rather than take one concept for the front and then ask them to extend it to the back, they've just gone, oh, well, those two front covers, stick one of them on the back.
Astounding Sounds obviously has a very similar theme, right?
Astounding Sounds, yeah. I would say even Levitation potentially has a bit of that to it because that piece of artwork on the back is very, very strong. I can imagine that was put forward to be a front cover. So yeah, I find that interesting. That looks what's happened here.
You wouldn't normally go to the trouble of typographizing the band name twice.
Exactly, exactly, because that's your brand. That would be on the T-shirts and the tour jackets and on the programs and everything. It's a strange thing, but there you go. You can imagine Dave having a phone call with the label and just going, look, I want a big metal hawk, and it's called Sonic Attack, basically. And then someone's gone, oh, yeah, we're going to see Dave tomorrow. Knock up some hawks. If you just took out the one off the back, kept the blue sky and the clouds thing, and you just put that in place of it, that'd be a pretty sweet cover.
Agreed. I feel like on the front cover, it gets less exciting as you go down. Like the start is like big hawk emblem, crazy amount of hawks, hawk heads, then lightning, and then font. And then the sonic attack at the end is kind of like, I've run out of budget. I'm just going to stick whatever font I've got left on there. You know, it doesn't really work in the same way.
And I prefer Hawkwind in the font on the back cover to the spiky version of it. So yeah, another slightly conflicted album cover story. That is what we think of Sonic Attack. As ever, we like to know how our views on Sonic Attack match up with the, what for want of a better word, you could call the mainstream Hawkwind audience, because I'm not even sure that there is such a thing as a mainstream Hawkwind audience. And to do that, we consult Elric Newby's book, Hawkwind Fans Worldwide Facebook Top 40 Albums, where he conducted a series of polls on a Facebook group to see where these albums go. And given the void of anybody else doing anything remotely similar, this becomes our litmus test to see where these albums come. So in the book, Sonic Attack comes in at a gross number 28, which is quite a long way down. However, if you strip out all of the live albums and compilations and things that are in there, you end up around 15, I think. But 15 out of 33, 34, it's about the halfway mark. I think that kind of attests to what you've certainly felt about it, being quite conflicted. You know, it's not that easy to get to. Of the ones that we've done, it is the lowest yet, because the lowest yet had been Hawklords, and Hawklords is three places higher. So it's the lowest ranking album that we've yet done. And yet, obviously, was number 19, which is 30 or 40 places higher than some of the albums we've done, which are considerably higher. So it's interesting what legacy does to these things.
Yeah. I wonder whether or not maybe being on RCA or something also helps that kind of thing. I don't know, you know, like what they do with marketing or promotion, or whether or not there are some people that look for the outputs of labels, especially around that kind of time, over necessarily bands and things. So it's difficult to know.
I suspect it was just very, very of its time.
Mm.
Which may be in a legacy thing, maybe it dates not quite so well. I've got to say, I've really enjoyed it, getting back into it. But we come at these from very, very, very different places. There's such a difference to an album that you know very well and were introduced to many years ago, coming back to and kind of growing into over a number of years and bringing kind of experience to. And as is the actual purpose of this podcast, seeing how these things actually stand up to a completely new listener. Even though, you know, your opinions are obviously yours, everybody else is going to have different ones. It's interesting getting that first point of view. I think this is the one where we've seen things more differently, I think, on Sonic Attack than we have on most of the others. Would you agree?
I think so. I think this is also the first time where I feel like Hawkwind have really encountered the 80s sound, where Levitation had a bit of it. It was close enough to the 70s for it to not sound the same. And I am not the biggest fan of the 80s sound. So I'm trying not to let that color my talking around this, because I don't just want to be like, oh, I hate it. And you know, like, I didn't have a lot of great nostalgia for the 80s. I hated a lot of 80s music. I thought like 80s pop was really annoying, and I had to withstand it throughout, you know, my student union days. I see it more affectionately than I did, for sure. So it's probably good that we're doing this now and not like, you know, 10 years ago when I was definitely very anti-80s for my own personal reasons. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes into it. But it's definitely a different album. And I think 80s notwithstanding, I still think it's one which has been, yeah, the most difficult to get through for whatever reason. Maybe because it is coming off the back of something like Levitation, which was so different. And them coming back to what I wanted was nice. A lot of it was fine, but I would probably put this where it is in terms of the rankings right now as well. I'm not surprised by that. So it'll be interesting from my point of view as well, just to see a band which isn't trying to be pop, you know, and not trying to sound like the 80s archetype. They will be sounding a bit 80s, because of course they will, but they'll be doing it in a way which I hope I will appreciate regardless.
Cool. Absolutely. And given all of that, it'll be very interesting to know what track from this album is going to make the Hawk Binge Master Playlist, and what will join it to be part of the Pork Binge Sessions playlist.
So for the master playlist, I'm going to go with Angels of Death. It's a standout track by itself. A lot of attitude, a lot going on, really nicely delivered. Brock vocals just feels like, to me, what I wanted this album to do a bit, which is to collect all the bits that was good about themselves and bring them back and just let you roll around in some Hawkwind nostalgia. And so for me, it's got all the right bits that tickle my Hawkwind boxes. And again, some nice bits of lyrics, well delivered, good strumminess, fun. Dire Straits, maybe. Who knows?
Bit of Hawkwind does Dire Straits.
Sultans of Death.
Sultans of Death. Excellent. And joining it in the Hawk Binge Sessions playlist alongside Royal Blood, Gong, Bonobo and Maxwell Sterling, what will join those from this album?
I was very close to putting Virgin of the World, but I've decided actually that I'm going to pick Living on a Knife Edge. For all its faults and all the things I'm not a big fan of it, I do like its message. I think it's useful to get one of these in the archive. I like how it finishes. It's a strange track that feels a little bit all over the place, which again feels quite Hawkwind to me. So despite me feeling like it could be done better, I like where it nets out. And I'll just give an honourable mention to Virgin of the World, which I like and will certainly be putting on a couple of playlists of my own.
Cool. Solid choices all round. And those playlists are where?
Well, playlist 1 to 3 and the Masters playlist is currently on Spotify. If you Google Hawk Binge, you'll find them. They come up nice and easy, as well as all of the podcasts. Playlist 4 will be shared in a few episodes' time when we have a nicer collection of tracks to really like fill it out.
Absolutely. And another piece of news regarding Spotify is that if any of you are listening to Hawk Binge via Spotify, you can now rate a playlist on Spotify. So if you are using Spotify, please do give us a good old rating there. It does help bring a new audience. As you saw with the YouTube channel, where we made that massive leap from 100 to 150 in just a couple of days, those are all people who are then new to the podcast and some of whom might even be new to the music. And that's what we want to do, is engage a whole load of people, either with music that they used to love or music they haven't heard yet, or just things that they're listening to all the time. So if you would do us a favor and look that up, that would be much appreciated. So Sonic Attack comes to an end. An interesting one for sure. Definitely a deep dive back into my past on that one, and a rather interesting set of responses from Matt. Matt, you're going to get much more closely acquainted with the track Sonic Attack in the next few weeks. Please, everyone, look out for the round one matches in Sonic Attack Ultimate Deathmatch. They are coming your way. For now, Matt, I suggest you stay as far away from the Sonic source as possible.
You've been listening to Hawk Binge. It was devised and presented by Andy Hood and Matt Longstaff. The soundtrack was produced by Don Music Presents. To contact the show, drop us a message on Instagram, Facebook or Twitter by searching at Hawk Binge, or send an email to podcast@hawkbinge.space. Hawk Binge is part of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. To find more great band-focused podcasts like this one, head to @deepdivepodnet on Twitter and dive in. Thank you as always for listening. We'll see you next time.